Catra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Catra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. We take on these massive, complex sources and, well, try to give you the key insights, the shortcuts to why they still matter.
And today, we're tackling a big one. A really big one.
Yeah, we're attempting to condense, what, 2,000 years of Chinese history? Yep. Basically the bedrock of Eastern civilization.
It sounds daunting, I know. But that's where the genius of Sima Qian comes in. We're diving into his records of the grand historian, the Shiji. He finished it around the first century BCE.
So it covers this vast sweep from, like, mythical figures like the Yellow Emperor all the way up to the Han Dynasty, which was his present day.
Exactly. An incredible scope.
And if you just see the sheer size of this thing, it's, well, it's intimidating. But our goal here, our mission today, is to get at the core argument, the reason this history feels so timeless.
Precisely. Sima Qian wasn't just, you know, writing down names and dates like a court secretary. He was really trying to establish history itself as a serious discipline.
Meaning, like, more than just a story.
Yeah, more than just a story. It needed objective analysis, rigorous checking, but also, and this is crucial, moral judgment. He wasn't just asking what happened. He wanted to know why.
Okay, so looking for deeper principles.
Universal principles, even, about how political power rises, how it stagnates, and, you know, how it inevitably falls. He was trying to understand human nature through history.
So if he actually managed to pull that off, to distill these huge cycles into some kind of foundational laws, then this book isn't just history, it's like a guide for us now.
That's the idea.
Which brings us to the big question for you listening. How can a history written literally over 2,000 years ago give us a shortcut, maybe, to understanding our own cycles of power, leadership, and frankly, institutional decay today? Okay. Let's unpack this. First off, to really feel the weight behind the Shiji, you have to understand the man himself. Sima Qian, born around 145 BCE.
Right. And he wasn't just some random scholar. He inherited his job, grand historian, or Taishi, from his father.
So it was a family thing, a legacy.
Very much so. And that position, it was the ultimate backstage pass.
Oh, how so?
Well, think about it. As grand historian, he had access that nobody else did. Imperial archives, secret state documents, family records of nobles, basically anything the government thought was important.
Okay, so he had the data.
He had the data, the scholarly training, a deep background in philosophy. Plus, he didn't just sit in an office. He traveled extensively across the empire.
Really? Doing what?
Talking to people, interviewing officials, soldiers, merchants, even just ordinary folks, trying to get the ground truth.
So incredible access, top-notch training, field work. He had it all. But the thing that gives his work its real lasting authority, it comes from something else, doesn't it? Something much darker.
Yes. It comes from intense personal suffering. Political persecution, really.
Yeah, this is the story about the general.
That's right. He spoke out to defend a general, Li Ling, who had surrendered to the enemy, the Xianyu. This was seen as incredibly disloyal, maybe even treasonous.
And the punishment was?
Castration. It was brutal. Designed not just as physical pain, but as the ultimate social and professional humiliation. The emperor, the court, they expected him to commit suicide to save face.
Wow. But he didn't.
He refused. He chose to live with the shame, the pain, the dishonor. Not out of fear, but because he felt he had a higher calling.
To finish the history, the work his father had started.
Exactly. And what's so powerful, so fascinating here, is that this trauma didn't crush him. In a strange way, it kind of liberated him.
What do you mean?
It gave him this incredibly profound firsthand understanding of how power gets abused, the injustices of the system, what real moral courage costs.
So the suffering forged his integrity.
I think so. It established him as this powerful moral authority. He earned the right to criticize the very emperors, the very system that had tortured him. He wasn't just reporting anymore, he was judging.
He didn't just endure it. He turned it into fuel for a work that would outlast emperors. That mix of deep scholarship and fierce moral independence, that's the heart of the Shiji.
Absolutely central.
Okay, let's shift to the book itself, the records. Because the structure Sima Qian used shows he wasn't just writing a history, he was building this, like, multi-dimensional model of the past.
Yeah, the scope and ambition were just unprecedented. His goal wasn't just to list events, it was moral instruction, political analysis, meant for officials, scholars, basically anyone in the future who wanted to understand how things worked.
He totally changed the game for how history was written, right?
Yeah, fundamentally. Instead of just one long narrative like this happened, then this happened, he broke it down to five distinct sections to capture, you know, all the different dimensions of society, not just the view from the throne.
Okay, so what are the five parts?
First, you have the basic annals. That's the chronological spine. Emperors, dynasties, the main sequence of events. Important, but fairly traditional.
Got it. Timeline.
Then there are chronological tables. These help sort out the incredibly complicated relationships between all the different states and families over time. Useful scaffolding.
Right, keeping track of who's who and when.
But then you get to the treatises, and this is where I think his genius really shines.
Okay, treatises on what? I know things like ritual and music were standard topics in classical China.
They are, and he includes those.
Yep.
But here's the kicker. He also includes incredibly detailed sections on hydraulic engineering, you know, managing rivers, canals, irrigation, and extensive chapters on economics.
Economics, like taxes and money.
Exactly. Taxation, currency, trade policies, agriculture. He's mixing these really practical, almost mundane topics with the high-minded stuff like court ritual.
Why do that? What's the connection between, say, music and flood control?
That's the key insight. Sima Qian understood that estate stability wasn't just about the emperor's virtue or having the mandate of heaven. He saw that if the infrastructure crumbled or the economy went sour, the whole thing could collapse.
So practical stuff matters just as much as ideology.
Maybe even more, sometimes. By putting engineering and finance right alongside ritual and cosmology, he's arguing that these material foundations are essential for good governance. A stable government needs to manage water well and have a sound currency. That's just as vital as performing the right sacrifices.
That really changes how you think about what government is for. Okay, so after treatises.
You get the hereditary houses. These focus on the histories of the major feudal states, places like Qi, Jin, the state of Qin, which eventually unified China, and the powerful noble families that ran them. It's like a series of mini dynastic histories within the larger history.
Looking at how power works at that next level down.
Right, how these powerful families rise and fall over generations. And then the final section, and maybe the most revolutionary of all, the biographies, or Li Zuan.
This is the part you said gets really interesting. Why?
Because Sima Qian basically decided that history isn't just made by emperors and nobles. He fundamentally broadened the scope of who counts as historically significant.
So who did he include in these biographies?
Well, you have the figures you'd expect. Mm-hmm. Confucius, brilliant government ministers, famous generals, standard historical fare.
Okay.
But then he includes these incredibly detailed portraits of people usually left out of official accounts. Thinkers, poets, doctors.
Even court entertainers.
Entertainers. Seriously.
Seriously. And crucially, figures like powerful merchants. Lu Buwei is a famous example, a merchant who became chancellor of Qin. That really challenged the traditional Confucian disdain for commerce.
Wow. And he didn't stop there, right? Not at all. He includes assassins like Jing Ke, who tried to kill the king of Qin. He includes rebels, philosophers who were out of favor, even people considered dissidents.
So by including merchants, assassins, rebels, what was his point?
His point, I think, was that history is shaped by everyone. All levels of society contribute to the outcomes we see. It wasn't just about grand pronouncements from the palace. Individual choices, individual lives, whether virtuous or deeply flawed, have consequences that ripple outwards. These biographies are like character studies, showing how individual agency works within the larger flow of history.
It's a much richer, more complete picture of the past, not just rulers, but the whole ecosystem.
Exactly. This incredible multi-layered structure. Annals, tables, treatises, houses, biographies allowed him to step back and see the bigger picture. To analyze history not just as one damn thing after another, but as maybe predictable patterns, cycles governed by understandable laws.
Okay, so let's talk about those laws. What are the core themes Sima Qian identified? His sort of rules for power?
Well, rule number one, you could say, is the mandate of heaven. This is a classic Chinese concept, but Sima Qian really drills down on it.
Which means?
Essentially, that legitimate political authority doesn't just come from having the biggest army or being born into the right family. It flows from moral virtue. From governing justly and effectively for the good of the people. The cosmos, or heaven, grants its mandate to rulers who behave well and withdraws it from those who become corrupt or tyrannical.
But couldn't that just be propaganda? Like, whoever wins says, see, heaven was on our side. He was writing under the Han Dynasty, after all. Didn't the mandate just justify their rule?
That's a fair question, and it's a tension he definitely grapples with. But Sima Qian wasn't just writing propaganda for the Han emperors. He used this idea combined with rule number two, cyclical patterns in history to issue a pretty stark warning to the Han.
Okay, what's the cyclical pattern?
He identified this recurring sequence. It starts with a dynamic, often virtuous founder who establishes a new dynasty. Then, over generations, their successors often become weaker, less competent, institutions start to decay, corruption creeps in, the rulers lose touch with the people,
leading to
popular suffering, unrest, rebellion, and eventually the dynasty collapses and is replaced by a new one, which often starts out virtuous again, and the cycle repeats.
So the message to the Han wasn't just, you guys are great because you have the mandate. It was more like,
you have the mandate now, but look at what happened to the dynasties before you. The Xia, the Shang, the Zhu, the Qin, they all follow this pattern. If you lose your virtue, if you become corrupt and neglect the people, you will fall too.
Wow. So it's a historical instruction manual on how not to screw up.
Exactly. It's a mechanism for holding power accountable, using the lessons of the past. But he doesn't suggest it's totally deterministic. That leads to rule number 3, the power of the individual.
So it's not just inevitable cycles. People can make a difference.
Yes. He balances the large-scale cycles with a focus on individual agency. He shows again and again how exceptional people, through acts of moral courage, like his own defense of General Li Ling, or through strategic genius, or even just sheer willpower, can alter the course of events. Think of Emperor Gaozu, the founder of the Han, who rose from a pretty humble background.
So individuals aren't just corks bobbing on the river of history.
Not in Sima Qian's view. Choices matter.
Mm-hmm.
Character matters. Individuals can shape their destiny and sometimes the destiny of nations.
Okay, that makes sense. And you mentioned a fourth rule linked back to those treatises.
Right. Rule number 4 is the crucial importance of the economic foundations. He makes it clear that political stability isn't just about morals or military might. It requires sound, practical economic management.
Like the hydraulics and taxes we talked about.
Precisely. He dedicates serious analysis to agricultural policy, fair taxation, stable currency, trade, ensuring people have basic necessities. He argues that you can't maintain legitimacy. You can't keep the mandate of heaven if the economy is failing, people are starving. Sound fiscal policy isn't optional. It's a prerequisite for long-term power.
You can't govern effectively on an empty stomach.
That sums it up pretty well.
Okay, Sima Qian's packed so much into this. Are there any, like, quick wisdom nuggets, memorable lines that capture his thinking?
Oh, definitely. The Shiji is full of them.
Two
really stand out for me in terms of his political philosophy.
Lay them on us.
First one, the highest type of ruler is one whose existence the people are barely aware of.
That sounds almost Taoist. Like, inaction is best.
It has that flavor, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think it's more about ultimate governmental efficiency and competence.
Mm.
If the systems, the laws, the economy, the infrastructure are working so smoothly, so justly, then the ruler doesn't need to constantly intervene or make a big show of their power.
So good governance is almost invisible, frictionless.
Exactly. It's subtle leadership based on wisdom and well-designed systems, not constant heavy-handed control. The opposite of a micromanager.
Okay, I like that. What's the second one?
This one reflects his deep belief in eventual accountability. Heaven's net is vast. Though its meshes are coarse, nothing escapes it.
Sounds a bit ominous. Cosmic justice.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
It's his conviction that, in the long run, truth will out. Corruption, abuses of power, moral wrongs. They might seem to go unpunished for a long time, maybe even generations. But eventually, history or heaven catches up. There's an ultimate reckoning.
So even if justice seems delayed, it's never truly denied.
That's the underlying faith there. It's a quiet assertion that historical truth and moral balance will eventually prevail, no matter how powerful the wrongdoers seem in the moment.
Those are powerful ideas. So thinking about us today, how do we apply this ancient wisdom? I mean, running a company or just trying to understand the news?
Well, the applications are surprisingly direct, I think. For anyone in a leadership position, Sima Qian offers a pretty clear warning. Don't rely just on your title or charisma.
Right. Your legitimacy, your mandate, comes from actually serving the people you lead, whether that's citizens or employees.
Exactly. You need to balance strategic goals with genuine compassion. Maintain consistent principles. If the system you oversee is failing the people within it, you're essentially losing your mandate, whether you're an emperor or a CEO.
And what about his focus on people outside the elite, like that merchant, Lu Buwei, you mentioned?
Yeah, Lu Buwei is a fantastic case study. He achieved incredible power and influence based purely on his talent, his wealth, his strategic mind, not noble birth. Sima Qian documenting that provides this powerful early argument for for meritocracy.
So recognizing talent wherever it comes from.
Absolutely. It's a strong case for merit-based advancement for social mobility, whether you're talking about ancient China or modern organizations. Sima Khan shows that ignoring talent just because it doesn't come from the right place is not just unfair, it's stupid.
Yeah.
It weakens the state or the company.
He basically argued that a system should be judged by who it allows to rise.
And that a healthy system needs talent from all levels. It connects back to those cycles of decay, right?
Yeah.
When rulers start promoting incompetent relatives and cronies, ignoring merit, that's a sure sign the system is failing. Sima Khan gives us the historical proof for why that road always leads to ruin.
So, wrapping this up, what Sima Khan created with the Shiji wasn't just a history book. It feels more like a timeless source of wisdom.
It really is. A masterclass in connecting incredibly detailed research with unflinching moral analysis. It's a guide to human nature, to how power works, to how societies organize themselves. And it feels just as relevant now as it did 2 millennia ago.
The big takeaway for me seems to be that sustainable systems, whether political or organizational, have to serve the common good. They need that legitimacy, that mandate.
And that while history might move in these huge sweeping cycles, individual character still matters immensely. Your choices, my choices, our integrity. They can influence those larger outcomes.
Sima Khan himself is the ultimate proof of that, isn't he? Choosing to endure that horrific humiliation to finish his work, using history as his ultimate weapon against unchecked power.
Which leaves us with a pretty powerful question, I think.
One.
For you, listening. In our own era, with information overload, a constant political pressure, incredibly complex systems, what's the price you're willing to pay, or maybe endure, for sticking to historical truth and maintaining moral clarity?
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Katra Foundation.